It's time once again for the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. Thanks for joining us. We have a collection of articles today, including a piece from the Florida Atlantic University describing research that shows an elevated risk of suicide among young adults with disabilities. We also will hear an article from Tech Policy Press addressing a provision of the newly passed House budget proposal that places a moratorium on AI regulations and how that will harm people with disabilities. You'll also hear a piece from CBS Philadelphia about a Pennsylvania mother who continues to go to bat for her visually impaired children. And we'll feature the latest from the Disability Scoop along with other articles as well. We'll start off the program with this piece from the New York Times entitled, Supreme Court Finds Retired Firefighter Cannot Sue for Disability Discrimination. It was written by Abby Van Sickle and Adam Liptak and published in the Times on June 20, 2025. The Supreme Court ruled on Friday that a retired Florida firefighter cannot sue her former employer under federal disability rights law for refusing to provide her the health benefits she had once been promised. Justice Neil M. Gorsuch wrote the opinion in a tangled decision, finding that because the alleged discrimination took place after the firefighter, Karen Stanley, had retired and left her job, she could not bring a lawsuit claiming that she was discriminated against in the workplace. Upholding a federal appeals court ruling, Justice Gorsuch wrote that the section of the Americans with Disabilities Act at issue in the case did not cover disability discrimination claims by retirees. In order to bring a successful claim, Justice Gorsuch wrote, a plaintiff must show that she held or wanted a job and could perform its essential functions at the time of the alleged disability-based discrimination. In a dissent, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, joined in part by Justice Sonia Sotomayor, argued that the justices had abandoned protections for vulnerable retirees. Disabled Americans who have retired from the workforce simply want to enjoy the fruits of their labor free from discrimination, Justice Jackson wrote, adding that Congress had plainly protected their right to do so when it drafted the federal disability rights law. Justice Sotomayor, in a separate writing, argued that a majority of the justices appeared in agreement that retirees may be able to bring disability discrimination claims for actions that occurred while they were still employed. Ms. Stanley might have been able to argue that this would apply to her case too, Justice Sotomayor wrote, but the court had not been asked to weigh in on that question. Ms. Stanley worked as a firefighter in Sanford, Florida, a city of about 65,000 people northeast of Orlando. When she started her job in 1999, the city offered health insurance until age 65 for two categories of retirees, those with 25 years of service and those who retired early because of disability. In 2003, the city changed its policy, limiting health insurance to those who retired because of a disability to just 24 months of coverage. After nearly two decades, Ms. Stanley retired in 2018 at age 47 after she was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. She expected that the city would continue to pay for most of her health insurance until she turned 65, but it refused, citing its changed policy. Ms. Stanley sued, claiming that the city had violated the ADA by providing different benefits to 25-year employees versus those who retired because of a disability. She argued that the city's policy amounted to impermissible discrimination based on disability. A federal trial judge dismissed her claim under the ADA, and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit agreed. In asking the justices to hear the case, Lawyers for Ms. Stanley said it could affect millions of disabled Americans who rely on retirement benefits that they earned while employed. One section of the ADA specifies that it is illegal to discriminate in compensation because of a disability. The justices wrestled with whether the section included retirees. Deepak Gupta, a lawyer for Ms. Stanley, said in an emailed statement that the decision had created a troubling loophole that allows employers to discriminate against retirees simply because they can no longer work due to their disabilities. In her dissent, Justice Jackson wrote that she hoped Congress might step in and provide a legislative intervention to shield other disabled retirees. This next article comes from Florida Atlantic University, and it's entitled, Suicide Risk Elevated Among Young Adults with Disabilities, by Giselle Galaustian, published June 17, 2025. Suicide remains one of the most pressing public health crises affecting young adults today, with devastating consequences. According to the United States Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, suicide is currently the third leading cause of death among individuals aged 18 to 25, with a 51% increase in suicide deaths between 2000 and 2021. While this trend is deeply concerning for the general population, it is even more alarming for young adults living with intellectual and developmental disabilities, IDD, a group long overlooked in suicide prevention efforts. Research by Florida Atlantic University and collaborators published in the journal Current Psychology sheds light on the growing concern of suicidality among young adults with IDD and the significant gaps in existing public health responses. Researchers conducted an extensive review of the literature to explore the elevated risk factors, theoretical frameworks, and practical prevention strategies urgently needed to address suicide in this vulnerable population. For too long, there has been a misconception that individuals with IDD are somehow protected from suicidality due to perceived cognitive limitations, said Alexander M. Fields, Ph.D., senior author and an assistant professor of counselor education with FAU's College of Education. However, emerging data clearly shows that young adults with IDD may actually face heightened suicide risk due to social isolation, abuse, trauma, and limited access to appropriate care and education. The researchers identify multiple contributing factors that may elevate suicide risk for individuals with IDD, including lack of access to education or employment opportunities, high rates of trauma, abuse, and bullying, increased dependence on caregivers, impulsivity and emotional dysregulation, social exclusion and stigma. A key barrier to effective prevention is diagnostic overshadowing, where symptoms of mental health disorders are misattributed to a person's disability, leading to underdiagnosis or misdiagnosis of suicidal ideation. Moreover, standard suicide screening tools are often developmentally inappropriate for individuals with IDD, further compounding the issue. To bridge this critical gap, the research draws upon two theoretical models, the Behavioral Pathway Model, BPM, and the Suicide Barometer Model, SBM, to propose a more inclusive approach to assessing and managing suicide risk in this population. These models were illustrated using a fictional case study of Anthony, a 21-year-old with autism and mild intellectual disability, demonstrating how structured frameworks can guide real-world prevention strategies. Our goal is to equip caregivers and helping professionals with practical tools and knowledge to identify warning signs, conduct effective assessments, and implement targeted interventions, said Fields. This includes training on communication strategies, appropriate use of adapted assessment tools, and recognizing that signs of suicidality may present differently in people with more severe disabilities. The researchers also discuss policy and public health recommendations for supporting young adults with IDD, including training healthcare providers on IDD-specific suicide risk factors, developing and validating screening tools sensitive to cognitive and communicative differences, ensuring crisis hotlines and emergency services are accessible and tailored to individuals with IDD, establishing community-based support networks to reduce stigma and isolation, funding additional research to develop inclusive and evidence-based interventions. This call to action is particularly urgent as mental health service access continues to lag for the IDD population, even as suicide risk rises. The researchers advocate for increased investment in both clinical and public health infrastructure to support long-term prevention efforts. Effective suicide prevention for young adults with IDD demands more than adapting existing models. It requires a wholesale reimagining of how we assess, support, and protect these individuals, said Fields. From school-based interventions to healthcare provider training, every level of the system needs to be part of the solution. This research marks a significant step forward in suicide prevention research by prioritizing the needs of individuals who are too often left out of the conversation. With continued attention, collaboration, and innovation, the researchers believe it is possible to turn the tide and build a more inclusive mental health support system. Study co-authors are Olivia J. Lewis, Ph.D., Oregon State University, Rebecca B. Smith-Hill, Ph.D., University of South Carolina, Megan Reynolds, Ph.D., Virginia Commonwealth University, Rachel Gilreath, Ph.D., University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh, and Madeline Castle, Ph.D., Mississippi State University. Next up, from Tech Policy Press, the proposed AI moratorium will harm people with disabilities. Here's how. By Ariana Abulafia and Travis Hill. Published June 19, 2025. Among Congress's chief duties is to pass a budget that appropriates funding for federal agencies. On May 22nd, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a budget reconciliation package that would structure government operations for the 2026 fiscal year, sending it to the Senate. As many disability rights and justice advocates have said, many provisions in the bill would have devastating impacts on people with disabilities, particularly the $600 billion in cuts to Medicaid that could lead to over 10 million people losing their health coverage. Buried deep in the bill is another provision that also has the potential to detrimentally impact disabled people. The proposed 10-year moratorium on the enforcement of state or local AI regulation. If enacted, it would prevent states and local governments from enforcing any law or regulation regulating artificial intelligence models, artificial intelligence systems, or automated decision systems, with limited exceptions. The bill aims to prevent states from regulating emerging technologies that have genuine benefits, but that also are putting their constituents at risk in very real ways, including those with disabilities. Indeed, Implementing AI tools in decision-making systems in high-stakes contexts like employment, education, and healthcare presents a particularly high risk of harm for people with disabilities. These risks have been previously referred to as tech-facilitated disability discrimination, an umbrella term that encapsulates all of the ways that AI and other emerging technologies can cause people to experience discrimination on the basis of their disability. While existing disability rights statutes, like the Americans with Disabilities Act, do provide some means of legal recourse for this type of discrimination, state-level AI regulation remains a vital avenue for harm mitigation. Previous research by the Center for Democracy and Technology, CDT, a nonprofit, has found that people with disabilities are disproportionately likely to be screened out from jobs as a result of their interactions with automated employment decision systems, or AI-enabled hiring tools, like video interview tools and personality assessments. In addition to presenting accessibility concerns, these tools also contribute to employment discrimination, wherein qualified disabled workers are blocked from jobs and employers miss out on valuable hires. Similarly, many facial recognition tools often simply do not work on people with certain disabilities, including individuals with facial differences and blind or low vision people. This is partially because these tools are trained using under-inclusive data sets, which leads to them being incapable of recognizing people with any sort of facial difference. These types of tools have been implemented into various systems. For example, they are built into testing software used by some schools and as a security measure for some types of transportation, among other things. As a result, facial recognition tools can impact the ability of disabled people to take tests, board airplanes, and more. As yet another example, AI-enabled tenant screening, where potential tenants are assigned a score that landlords or property management companies then use to determine whether or not to offer them a lease, also poses additional risks for disabled people. These scores can consider medical debt as a negative factor when making these determinations. People with disabilities are twice as likely to carry past due medical debt than those without disabilities. And as a result, this process can impact the ability of disabled people to secure housing. Finally, as previously outlined in Tech Policy Press, disabled people may disproportionately experience harm as a result of surveillance pricing. While there are several pending state-level bills that aim to regulate this practice, the moratorium would likely prevent many or all of them from being enforced. Across the nation, states have been active in writing and passing laws that aim to regulate emerging technologies, including the use of facial recognition technology and other biometrics, particularly in the context of policing. State and local legislators have also enacted laws to regulate the use of AI in hiring, particularly whether or not a company can do so without notifying applicants, and bills have been proposed that would similarly provide transparency in the use of AI tools for housing-related decisions. The AI moratorium would likely prevent enforcement of all these laws. A recent paper by Americans for Responsible Innovation argues, for example, that Illinois House Bill 3773, which prohibits employers from using AI in employment decisions if it causes discrimination against protected classes, would likely be voided by the moratorium. The report also found that SB 24-205, Colorado's AI Act that was also passed last year, is similarly likely to be voided by the moratorium. This bill requires transparency for the use of high-risk systems, such as those that could lead to discriminatory outcomes for groups such as people with disabilities. The scope of the moratorium appears broad enough that it would prevent states from regulating all sorts of technologies and tools, to the detriment of people with disabilities and other constituents nationwide. Importantly, as currently drafted, and despite claims to the contrary, the moratorium appears to further endanger the use of general-purpose consumer protection and civil rights laws at the state level from being enforced when AI systems are involved, making entities that use them truly unaccountable for the harms they cause. The harms from AI tools and other emerging technologies are not inevitable, and there are real benefits to some of these technologies, including their incorporation into assistive technology tools for disabled people. Many pending or past state-level AI bills aim to allow people, both with and without disabilities, to enjoy the benefits of emerging technology while being largely protected from the risks. But the moratorium would prevent all of that. More than 70 million adults in the United States are disabled, around one out of every four U.S. adults. The impacts and risks that these individuals face in their interactions with emerging technologies will only grow over the next 10 years. While the provision has significant procedural issues, such that it should get removed from the proposed budget reconciliation bill, it is likely that proponents will continue to push for a similar moratorium in other must-pass legislation if it fails now. Prohibiting state lawmakers from passing AI bills to protect their constituents, both with and without disabilities, is more than procedurally unlawful. It is simply bad policy. This next article comes from Atoll Daily News. It's entitled, New Ways to See: Northfield Artist Shares Gifts Despite Impending Blindness, by Eveline McDougall. Faced with total vision loss in the near future, many people might understandably respond with despair, fear, anger, or all three. Yet Virginia Jinx Hastings, 80, faces such loss in inspiring ways. After undergoing more than a dozen procedures for glaucoma, Hastings learned that she's exhausted surgical solutions. Her response was to create art, which is currently on display through July in the Dickinson Memorial Library in Northfield. When I found out that I'll soon completely lose my sight, I felt an urgency to be creative, which is something I've done all my life, said Hastings. A longtime ceramic artist, the Northfield resident pivoted to painting during the COVID era. I painted dog portraits for neighbors and friends, she said. It was a medium I could handle. For years, Hastings loved to sew, but her disability took that hobby off the table. I paint with acrylics using my fingers, which puts me in direct contact with the canvas. I can't see a brush at this point. Self-pity was the furthest thing from her mind when Hastings learned of her prognosis. Independence is very important to me, but of course I need help and will need more help. She credits her husband, Howard, for being wonderfully supportive. For now, Howard is my white stick, she said, referring to the aid used by blind people. Low vision and blindness can easily lead to isolation, so I'm figuring out all of that. But my first impulse was to do something creative. Both Jinx and Howard trained at the Rhode Island School of Design, RISD. Following a 30-year teaching career, Jinx found other ways to share her gifts while promoting her most cherished values. She addresses the waste stream by transforming junk mail and other paper destined for recycling bins into beautiful 3D pieces, each containing just one word. "I've given away over 300 of these," she said, pointing to an example currently gracing library walls. "I want to inspire people with words like gratitude, empathy, and courage." Each piece appears as an embossed message in soothing shades of gray. The art Jinx created in the last couple of years is full of color and geometry. The description most frequently heard from exhibit attendees was vibrant. Jinx noted that the conditions of her workspace must be neither too bright nor too dim. "I'm like Goldilocks in that way," she joked. "It has to be just right." In a more serious vein, she said, "Everything I see now is blurry and tunnel vision. That's become the reality of my life, so I wanted to do something colorful and happy, and that's how I felt while making these pieces, colorful and happy." Hastings tries to keep doing things she's always loved. "I love to cook and have memorized many recipes," she said. "The key is that everything must be put back in the place where it belongs, so when I need nutmeg, it's right where I think it is." She recently made cookies for a monthly coffee hour at her local library and did so easily because she's made them so many times. "For new recipes," she said, "I ask Alexa. Technology has become very important to people like me. I'm an old dog learning new tricks." She recently experimented with an app called Be My Eyes. A volunteer on the other end describes exactly what you're looking at. It could be someone in Texas helping you pick out an outfit. Howard Hastings is a longtime woodworker with prodigious imaginative skills. At his wife's exhibit, he handed an unusual pair of glasses to an onlooker and said, "You can put these on to get a sense of what Jinx sees at this point." Howard created the glasses after interviewing his wife in order to gain a detailed understanding of her visual limitations and approximated her reality by drilling small holes in dark material. "I want to try to show others what Jinx experiences. Everything is cloudy, she has no peripheral vision, and all she sees are pinholes. Donning the glasses gave me an immediate feeling of disorientation. A few others tried them on too. Most people took them off quickly." At the exhibit, Jinx was thrilled to meet Cedar Parent, age 11, who in January was the featured artist in the same gallery space. When asked about the nature of his exhibit, Cedar described his nature photos featuring insects and amphibians. Cedar, his mom, and his sister took in the work of Jinx Hastings with great interest. His mom, Katie, said, "I'm blown away. The work is so beautiful." Zen Parent, age 8, nodded in agreement. Cedar commented on the mathematical nature of his fellow artist's work, and his mom said, "Math is how Cedar's brain functions." Jinx uses painter's tape to create grids before applying paint, later peeling off the tape to reveal wondrously geometric designs. "I like the way your work is positioned," Cedar said. His sister commented, "I can't pick just one favorite. There are too many good ones." Northfield resident Patricia Kinsella visited the exhibit briefly, admitting, "I'm playing hooky from work. Pioneer graduation is tonight, but I just had to come see this." After viewing the pieces once more before heading back to work, Kinsella said, "It's an artistic triumph." Now a reminder, this is the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. Well, our next piece comes from MSN. It's entitled, "Woman Who Lost Her Sight to Diabetes Defies Odds, Earns Her Master's Degree at 54. by Dolita O'Keen. LaShawn Bentley Harley Hill saw her dreams come to reality. She recently graduated from Louisiana State University in Shreveport, LSUS, with a master's degree in counseling at the spring commencement ceremony, despite having lost her vision due to diabetes in 2017. The crowd at Brookshire Grocery Arena gave her a standing ovation as she walked across the stage with help from Patience Davis, the Access and Advocacy Coordinator. Harley Hill told LSUS, "It felt really amazing. I started to tear up many times that day, but I didn't want to mess up my makeup. I wanted to stay pretty for my photos. It was an amazing feeling to know that all of my classmates were looking for me at graduation, and I got big hugs from classmates and LSUS staff. I got home that day, took my makeup off, and just cried." Tears are nothing new to the 54-year-old, who said that as her eyesight gradually deteriorated to the point of complete blindness on January 17, 2017, she cried every day for a month. "I thought, God, I can't do this," Harley Hill said. "I can't drive. I've got to depend on people. I felt like a burden. My husband, Columbus, told me, it's okay, it's not the end of the world, and that people go through what they go through. Just ask God for help, and we're going to get through this." The reason she can still clearly recall the date when she went blind is that it was the day following Zeta Phi Beta Sorority Incorporated's Founders Day. She was an active Greek during her undergraduate student days at Morgan State University, where she received a bachelor's degree in psychology as a sighted person. Nonetheless, her age and blindness did not deter her. She excelled in her master's program thanks to her extensive support system. 2.5 years ago, Harley Hill was encouraged to go back to school by the Louisiana Association of the Blind, LAB, and Louisiana Rehabilitation Services made it possible financially through a grant. Tony Collins was an employment specialist, and I had talked about wanting to counsel and talk to people, Harley Hill recalled. She asked about me going back to school. I said, "At my age? Well, okay, let's do it." Harley Hill finally earned a 3.9 GPA for her degree, which included 4 more classes for a rehabilitation track. Columbus, her spouse, drove her home from Bossier City after picking her up from class after hours. She used SporTrans Lifeline, now on demand, to commute to LSUS and her different practicum and internships, which is part of the City of Shreveport's paratransit program. She worked for what is now Ochsner LSU Health Hospital during her slow visual impairment, so optometrist Dr. Scott Cavanaugh sent her to the LAB for assistance in restoring everyday life tasks. She recounted, "My husband had to reorganize my clothes, my closet, and our home so I'd know where everything is." Harley Hill has been married for 9 years. She added, "An occupational therapist came in and made sure I knew where everything is, putting bump stops on different things. I get around really well now." LAB provided Harley Hill with a smart cane, a computer with software that can read to her, and technical support. She recalled, "LSUS professors were very understanding in giving me time to complete my assignments. Email was the key for me, and they worked with me and converted everything I needed into Word. When I wrote papers, LSUS librarians like Abigail McCoy and Martha Duzat would help me pull articles based on my topic." Since she recorded lectures for later listening, Harley Hill remarked that her voice recorder was a lifeline. Every semester, a mobility instructor assisted Harley Hill in finding her classes on campus. Smart canes are equipped with GPS technology that helps the user navigate and recognize obstacles. There were times when I wanted to throw in the towel because there's a lot going on, but I didn't give up, Harley Hill admitted. I also had a lot of strong classmates like Jacob Rogas. They texted me to make sure I was good, sometimes offering advice on how to accomplish something. Strong classmates and church members got me through it. Harley Hill will formally begin her new profession as a counselor at Pelican Bayou Counseling in Shreveport soon after her practicum and internships with Louisiana Rehabilitation Services and Uprising Addiction Center. I got great experience in working with people with everything from deafness and vision impairment to people dealing with substance abuse, Harley Hill said. I can offer hope as a counselor and use my experiences to help others. I hope I can be an inspiration and an example of not giving up. Just because things happen in life, don't count yourself out. Anything is possible through faith, and you can do anything if you set your mind to it. Harley Hill, who explained that diabetes runs in her family and isn't diet-related in her case, said, "A disability doesn't stop you from doing things. It just might slow you up a little bit. We can do just as much as anybody else. It might just take a little longer." Next up from CBS Philadelphia, Pennsylvania mother continues to go to bat for her visually impaired children with screenplay Curveball by Stephanie Stahl. Fighting for inclusion and ways to overcome adversity, that's the theme of a new movie in the works from a mother in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. This is a family with two sons who have very limited vision, but that hasn't stopped them from belonging to sports teams, accomplishments that came after their mother went to bat for them. Kristen Smedley is back in her field of dreams in Richboro, the setting for a screenplay she wrote about convincing a little league to allow her partially blind 10-year-old son to play on a team. It's the story of the power of inclusion, of fighting for inclusion, she said. Her son Michael, who's 25 now, said the team eventually rallied around him. "We were able to talk with them and make some accommodations, like hitting off a tee and playing the outfield with another guy on the team," he said. The team went on to win a championship. Now, the screenplay called Curveball is a finalist in the Authentic Global Films Awards. "Blindness is not a curveball," Kristen Smedley said. "Things that we maybe perceive as barriers and challenges can actually end up being strengths when you look at it and reframe it from a different perspective," Michael Smedley said. CBS News Philadelphia first introduced you to the Smedley family in 2017. Michael has a younger brother, Mitchell, who's also visually impaired. "Having two blind kids initially, that was the most devastating news," Kristen Smedley told us in 2017. But the Smedley boys, who played air hockey by listening for sounds, quickly learned how to turn adversity into opportunity. "It's more difficult, but it's just daily living. People live with all kinds of challenges," Mitchell Smedley, 21, said. "Blindness is a version of that." Mitchell Smedley also played baseball. His mother was determined that her sons would get every opportunity possible. "Youth sports, done right, build incredible human beings, and that's what happened on this field," she said. The boys' mother hopes production of the movie can start soon. She's still working on fundraising. Michael and Mitchell Smedley have both gone on to graduate from college and are working on their careers. Our next article comes from the Disability Scoop, entitled, Senate seeks deeper cuts to Medicaid, amplifying worries about disability services. By Michelle Diament. Published June 23, 2025. Just weeks after the U.S. House of Representatives approved billions in cuts to Medicaid, the Senate is considering chopping the program even more, a move that advocates say would have dire consequences for people with disabilities. Senate Republicans unveiled legislation last week detailing sweeping changes to Medicaid that are part of a broader effort to make good on President Donald Trump's domestic agenda. The measure includes more aggressive changes than the version passed by the House in May. Both chambers are seeking to impose work requirements on many Medicaid beneficiaries and mandate that states check individuals' eligibility for the program more frequently. Among other changes, but some of the Senate's requirements would be more stringent. Notably, the Senate is also seeking to limit Medicaid provider taxes, a workaround that states use to collect more federal dollars for the program. The Senate took a rotten bill and made it worse, said Elena Hung, co-founder and executive director of Little Lobbyists, a national group advocating for kids with disabilities. The Senate text cuts even more money from Medicaid and will result in even more harm to medically complex and disabled children. While neither bill explicitly calls for spending on disability services to be slashed, advocates say that reducing federal investment in Medicaid will put financial pressure on states, leading to cuts in optional programs like home and community-based services. History shows that when Medicaid budgets are cut, home and community-based services are among the first services cut, said Hung, whose group brought families from across the country to Capitol Hill last week to pressure senators to reject Medicaid cuts. Millions of Americans, including disabled and medically complex children, are in imminent danger of losing Medicaid. The threat is dire. The latest proposal comes after more than 1,100 organizations from across the nation, led by the Disability and Aging Collaborative and the Consortium for Constituents with Disabilities, sent a letter to Senate leaders decrying the potential Medicaid cuts as dangerous and life-threatening. As we've repeatedly emphasized, there is no way to carve out people with disabilities and older adults from the harm of these cuts, the advocates wrote. The vast majority of optional Medicaid spending, 86%, goes toward services and supports for people with disabilities and older adults, with home and community-based services accounting for more than half, the letter indicates. When federal Medicaid funding was reduced between 2010 and 2012, every state cut home and community-based services in some fashion, the advocates said, and waiting lists greatly increased. Republican lawmakers insist that their proposal would achieve savings and extend tax cuts instituted during Trump's first term while ensuring that Medicaid serves those it's intended for. The bill targets waste, fraud, and abuse in spending programs while preserving and protecting them for the most vulnerable, said Senator Mike Crapo, Republican from Idaho, chairs the Senate Finance Committee. Nicole Jorwick, Chief Program Officer at Caring Across Generations, an organization advocating for caregivers and people who rely on them, rejected that characterization and said the Senate proposal took her and other advocates by surprise. This is a significant threat because we weren't expecting the Senate to actually make the Medicaid cuts deeper, she said. These cuts would be historic and would have an outsized impact on services for people with disabilities. This bill does nothing to change that home and community-based services are optional under the law. So when cuts come to the state level, the first place they will cut is optional services. Waiting lists will grow, providers will close, and the DSP shortage will worsen. We know at least 2.6 million HCBS jobs would be at risk. We have to take action and tell the Senate to pull out Medicaid cuts, Jorwick said. Here's another piece from the Disability Scoop entitled PBS Documentary Spotlights Caregiving by Sean Heasley, published June 24, 2025. A new documentary highlighting the experiences of the millions of paid and family caregivers across the nation is set to premiere. The two-hour film, Caregiving, focuses on the personal experiences of six caregivers while examining the historical context and current efforts to tackle the growing need for care. The caregiving experience I had with my father inspired this documentary, said actor Bradley Cooper, an executive producer of the film whose father had lung cancer. I was lucky enough that I was able to be there for my dad, and I certainly benefited from the help we also got from others. Caregivers are heroic people. Their ability to focus and give all of themselves is something I stand in awe of. I came to appreciate how we need to care for caregivers better. It is my hope that caregiving will provide affirmation and support for those who do this profoundly meaningful and increasingly vital work. There are an estimated 53 million to 105.6 million adults and 5.4 million children or adolescents in the U.S. providing unpaid care to a friend or loved one who is ill, aging, or has a disability. In addition, there are some 5 million paid caregivers. Those behind the documentary also created 18 short films looking at caregiving experiences, programs, and perspectives, which are available online. And they are working with Fred Rogers Productions to create video content, lesson plans, and other activities about caregiving from PBS series including Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood, Don Quixote, and Alma's Way for children ages 2 to 6. The Children's Initiative is expected to launch this fall. Over the past 12 months, the production team and I have traveled throughout the country, spending time with family and professional caregivers of all ages and backgrounds, said Chris Durance, director and senior producer of the documentary. We have come to appreciate that every family has a care story, and we hope that this film inspires viewers to share their own, building new communities of care that will bring us all closer together. Caregiving will air Tuesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on PBS stations nationwide and is available to stream on PBS.org and the PBS app. And finally, FBI arrests man accused of bilking $100 million from Special Needs Trust by Christopher O'Donnell, Tampa Bay Times. Tampa, Florida. For more than 15 years, hundreds of victims of car accidents, medical malpractice lawsuits, and others trusted Leo Giovanni to care for large sums of money they had battled for years to win in court. He told them he would invest and grow their money. With his business accountant, John Wittek, he produced reassuring financial statements every year showing their money was safe. But in reality, Giovanni siphoned roughly $100 million from more than 1,500 trust funds and lived a lavish lifestyle that included a private jet and executive suites at the Tampa Bay Buccaneers Stadium and the Kentucky Derby, court records filed by the U.S. Attorney's Office show. When a client needed money for a medical expense, he would take it from someone else's account in a Ponzi-like scheme. After a year-long-plus investigation, FBI agents early Monday morning arrested Giovanni in his Feather Sound home, neighbors said. They were awakened by agents shouting FBI through a bullhorn. Witek was also arrested. The pair face 4 counts of mail fraud, 5 counts of wire fraud, and 1 count of money laundering. Giovanni faces additional charges of bank fraud, illegal monetary transactions, and a false bankruptcy declaration. If convicted of all charges, Giovanni could face up to 30 years in prison, U.S. Attorney's Office prosecutor Michael Gordon said during Giovanni's bail hearing. Witek's maximum sentence would be 20 years. A conviction could also result in Giovanni's wife and children losing their homes, which prosecutors say were partly or fully bought using stolen funds and could be taken in forfeiture. They perpetrated a massive fraud scheme to steal critical financial resources from some of society's most vulnerable victims, both physically and mentally disabled, many of them children, Greg Kehoe, the U.S. Attorney for the Middle District of Florida, said during a press conference to announce the indictment. Dressed in a faded Tampa Bay Lightning Stanley Cup Champions t-shirt and sweatpants, Giovanni was shackled when he appeared in federal court Monday afternoon for a first appearance. He looked across the courtroom to the public benches where his wife, Jane Giovanni, and daughter, Caitlin Janicki, sat. Giovanni pressed his shackled hands to his mouth and then gestured toward them. The U.S. Attorney's Office described Giovanni as presenting a substantial risk of flight and asked that bail be set at $1 million, that he surrender his passport, and be subject to location monitoring. He treated people with mental and physical disabilities as marks. He took advantage of children, a motion filed by prosecutors stated. He victimized some of the most vulnerable people in society, people who had already suffered unfathomable tragedies and difficulties in their lives. Federal Judge Amanda Sansone said she was surprised that prosecutors weren't asking for more stringent bail conditions and scheduled a detention hearing for Thursday. She ruled that Giovanni will remain incarcerated until then. More than $850,000 is missing from the trust fund set up for Cape Coral resident Keenan Freeman, who has developmental delays. He suffered severe seizures after receiving a vaccine when he was 18 months old that affected his development. He relies on a wheelchair and has limited verbal skills. His mother, Rebecca Bowman, said that it had been a long wait to learn that someone might be held responsible for the crime. I just felt like the victims in this case ultimately feel some relief knowing he's been arrested, she said. We've put our faith in the justice system and we're finally seeing something happen. Kehoe said there may be additional indictments to come. Giovanni had personal and business attorneys who helped form the dozens of firms that he used to transfer stolen funds between. Janicki, his daughter, was employed by Giovanni's nonprofit until about 2020, and Giovanni co-ran Big Storm Brewing with his son, L.J. Giovanni. The firm received stolen trust fund money, the indictment states. Giovanni's arrest comes after bankruptcy courts stripped Giovanni of ownership of more than 120 of his companies, including Big Storm. He was also found in contempt in civil court and fined $300,000 for not providing subpoenaed financial records. In 2000, Giovanni set up the Center for Special Needs Trust Administration, a St. Petersburg nonprofit that administered trust funds. He grew it into one of the nation's largest special needs trust administrators, with more than 2,000 trusts from across the nation. But it filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in February 2024, after officials found that $100 million had been taken from more than 1,500 trust funds as loans. The money had been transferred over roughly 10 years to Givony's Boston Finance Group, court records state. It was never repaid, leaving hundreds of trust fund holders with injuries and disabilities with no money for medical and living expenses. A forensic accountant's report shows that trust fund money wired to Givony's Boston Finance Group was then distributed to roughly a dozen other companies that he owns. That includes $16 million that was sent to Big Storm Brewing. In addition to a private jet, Givony doled out hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign contributions to politicians. Well, that concludes our program. Thank you for tuning in to the Disability News. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader, inviting you to join us again next time.